we've covered quite a bit of material. We have one way to define mindful awareness, concentration, clarity, and together. So that's sort of what is mindfulness, at least one way to think about it. We also have a clear idea of why mindfulness is a good thing, how those skills allow us to experience the discomforts of the body with less suffering, the pleasures of the body with greater fulfillment. We have an idea of how those skills allow us to gain insights, both personal insights, but also deeper insights, transpersonal insights, spiritual insights. We have an idea of how those skills allow us to change behaviors, improve how we carry ourselves in the world, and how mindfulness ultimately leads to a sense of service to others. When you understand your source, when you get the insight, the deepest insight, into the question, who am I? The answer is that there's a part of each one of us that's so deep that it's outside of us and shared by everyone. And that's our... So, because you're linked to everyone, the bodhicitta, the bodhisattva aspiration to serve everyone is a natural consequence. It's all over the world. The mature spiritual path always has an aspect of work we do on ourselves for ourselves, and then an aspect of what we put out into the world. In the Hindu, it's called sadhana seva. Sadhana is formal practice, work you do on yourself, for yourself. Seva is service. Even it sounds like the word service. That's just a coincidence, but it means what you put out into the world. In Buddhism, you have, in early Buddhism, you have... Panya Sampara, which is like, you have Panya Sampara, which is accumulating wisdom, but you also have Punya Sampara, which is sort of equivalent in some ways. The word Punya in Pali is in some ways equivalent to like mitzvot. It's like good deeds, your good karma, and these work together. That's in early Buddhism. In Mahayana, they talk about shunyata and karuna, okay? Understanding emptiness, but then a direct link to compassion that comes through that, because the emptiness is, it sort of sounds bleak, but actually emptiness is rich and vibrant and connective. So the emptiness connects you to everyone, so from that comes the compassion. And then that's Mahayana, and then in Vajrayana they talk about prajna and upaya, wisdom, and then upaya is reaching out, it's approaching others. Same notion is present in Judaism, it's present in Christianity. There's always these two sides. For example, the Dominican order in Christianity, their motto was contemplare et dare alias fructum contemplativum. I like this. It's in Latin. It says, meditate and give to others the fruits of meditation. That's the motto of the Dominican. They're the ones that, they're called Black Friars. They wear like a black outfit. So it's the same all around the world. So we have an idea of what these skills are, and we have an idea of why we want to practice them. I also gave you a pretty detailed description of an outline of how these kinds of things evolved through history, and specifically how Buddhism evolved into three major practice traditions, the Hinayana, which is small vehicle, Mahayana, the great vehicle, Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, and how that spread. So that gives us an idea of where this came from. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, someone pointed out to me, when I gave the description of the history of Buddhism in India and its demise around the year 1200, I did not mean for a moment to say anything disparaging about Islam. That was just a historical fact, okay? It happened. Stuff happens. I'm not trying to demonize and say, oh, well, they destroyed Buddhism and blah, blah, blah. It's just, it happened. People of that time had limited points of view as far as they were concerned. It was just a bunch of idol worshippers. I'm sure that's how it would have looked to those people. So it happened. You know, it's very interesting from my perspective, being that I was born in 1944. So the United States was fighting Japan when I was born. My father was in the Pacific fighting the Japanese when I was born. When I grew up, when I was a little kid, the Japanese were demonized. They were horrible. They were the enemy. They sneak attacked us. They abused prisoners of war. They were monsters. That's what I grew up with. And that's very interesting because in essence, I owe everything to the people of Japan, who I am. Everything that makes me what I am is a gift they gave me. The enemies of my father's, so to speak. And it just sort of makes you think about things, how things change, and you know, I mean, it's like I owe everything to Japan. And Japanese masters, they accepted me. They gave me everything they had. They never thought of me as a foreigner. Never, you know, anything. It was just, you're interested, you can speak our language, and, you know, we have these wonderful things, and we just give them to you. And you take them back and use them freely. So, you know, just, it's a little different, makes me think about things. I mean, I can remember when I was first in Japan, before I did any meditation, I was a student. I was 20 years old, and I was a university student in Tokyo. So, you know what university students do in Japan? Well, not a lot of study, because by the time you're out of high school in Japan, you have a college education, okay? High school is like American college. So when they get into college, they goof off. they do political demonstrations, they drink, at least in my day, okay? So I was a Japanese-style university student in Tokyo. So I used to go out drinking. And when Japanese drink, they sing. Well, that's where the karaoke, that Americans call karaoke, okay? Karaoke, all that sort of stuff, that comes from Japanese bars originally. So they sing. So I learned songs. I learned every kind of Japanese song, popular songs, folk songs, songs in dialects, and World War II army songs. Okay, and I just learned everything. So once I was in this bar, and they were singing this song that's the it's called Doki no Sakura. It's it means it's the song of the kamikaze special attack corps, the suicide pilots in World War II, the ones that were trying to kill my father on the ship. But I knew that song. I knew it in Japanese. Kisama to ore to, I can't say that. I have to be sake. Kisama to ore to wa doki no sa. Because you and I, old buddy, are cherry trees blooming in the same squadron garden. Because we know we're cherries, we know that eventually we will fall. Let us fall beautifully for our country. Yeah, it's a little heavy. It's Buddhist. So it's the mixture of good and bad. It's totally Buddhist. It talks about after we're dead, we'll be born again at the national shrine of Japan, and we'll blossom as flowers together. I mean, it's like totally Buddhist. It's totally virtue, and it's totally evil, just completely intertwined, because it was used for crazy suicide violence. So anyway, someone started to sing it, and I joined in. An American, right? Well, first of all, they were just amazed that I know anything like that. And this guy came up to me afterwards, and he was like crying. And it was, he'd been in World War II, and he had all this stuff and this guilt, and there was just this connection. You know, this, so, you know, I think about things like that. So not, definitely not to demonize. And you can, things change, okay? I mean, I run all my retreats in Catholic centers in the United States. They love us. They tell us, we love having you Buddhists because you remind us of what we're supposed to be doing. Well, you know, it wasn't that way when I was a kid, okay? I was before Vatican II. It was like, it was not open like that. It's inconceivable to me. If you'd have told me, you know, when I was 14 years old that Buddhist meditators would be welcome. Do you know that there's Zafus in the Vatican in Rome? I mean, it's just amazing. People sitting, doing this kind of practice in the Vatican. Anyway, it's just, if someone had said this is, you know, this will be what the world's like in the 21st century, I would never believe it. I mean, it's like totally off my radar. But it happens. So it's not inconceivable to me that in 50 years, there'll be retreats like this in Riyadh, Cairo, Damascus. Okay, it's not, weirder things have happened. Okay? weirder things have happened. So,
inshallah.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, something. I just wanted to mention that to say nothing of the fact that although I didn't go into it and would like to at some time. Islam has its own meditation tradition. I think most of you probably know that, tasawwuf, Sufism. And what the nirodha, the cessation, the gone, in Arabic, delving back into Allah, into God. terms right there. It's just like everywhere else. So they have it too. And so just wanted to mention that. I didn't want to give the wrong impression about things. Okay. So one last thing to talk about. Where to go from here? The retreat ends. So what do we need? What do we need to know when we think about, okay, we're going to now be transitioning? So you have the highest probability of success with this practice if you can establish a certain rhythm in your life. Many of you have this rhythm, but I just want to mention it specifically. The rhythm is do a little bit of formal practice most days. And every once in a while do an intensive silent retreat like this. So the bare minimum that this is like absolute minimum, 10 minutes a day of formal practice. I mean, that's a real minimum. A lot of teachers will, Mr. Goenka says 2 hours a day. But then people can't do it, and then they get disillusioned, and they don't do any. Well, 10 minutes compared to zero, okay, the ratio of 10 divided by zero is infinity, okay? So it's infinitely better to do 10 minutes than to do 0 minutes. It's the way I look at it. Okay, so I know you can't divide by zero, but you get the general idea here. But that means 10 minutes of actual practice. It's not 10 minutes of relaxing in a bubble bath, okay? If you really are only doing 10 minutes, I strongly encourage spoken labels, because you're going to have to work for quality over quantity. But try to do at least 10 minutes, at least that. A lot of people do 20 minutes, half hour, what have you. So a little bit of formal practice most days. There's no one that is so busy that they can't do 10 minutes. Okay, then at least one retreat like this per year. This is minimum. And now we're talking about for one's whole life, keeping this up, because we're not monks and nuns. We're not in the caves of Tibet or the forests of Southeast Asia or desert of the Sinai. We're just here having householders' lives. So the results may be a little slower for us because we've made a decision that we want to do these other things. We're not going to be full-time meditation. So it's not so much how much did you meditate this month, it's will you still be meditating 5 years from now, 20 years from now? It's the long haul. It's a long-term endeavor. So if you can do a little bit each day, a lot every once in a while, that's the rhythm. And then the other thing is, during the day, try to have at least several moments where you reestablish a technique. So maybe you have to work and you have to just give yourself to whatever job you're doing. But then when you walk to the washroom or you have, you take a lunch break, you have 30 seconds here, 3 minutes there, 10 minutes there. You reestablish a technique during the day. So you pepper the day with surgical strikes of formal practice. Some people have their watch go off every few hours, okay, try to remind them. You may have heard of a mindfulness bell. You can use different cues or set something up on your computer that will remind you to sort of touch base. So you try to bring mindfulness into daily life intentionally. And if you can establish this rhythm of retreats, day-to-day formal practice, and intentionally meditating during the day at least a little bit, and you keep this rhythm up for your whole life, then I cannot guarantee enlightenment, but I can give you a high probability you will not regret having done this. So I choose my words carefully. I don't want to make irresponsible promises. High probability you will not regret. And, you know, so the results will be there. It's basically a matter of attitude. You come to look upon your day as a sort of, as an ashram, as a, it's like things come up and what can I do with my practice? You know, this is sort of interesting. How can I work with this? How can I strategize about that? It's an attitude about what your days are. So that attitude combined with this rhythm is likely to produce success. So if you just did retreats, you might tend to a pattern of some peak experiences and then you sort of like completely deflate. If you just do day-to-day practice, you might have a pattern of growth, but it's very slow. If you do retreats plus day-to-day, you sort of like move forward on the retreat, and yes, you go somewhat back when you go back to daily life, but your daily practice backs you up so you don't like completely go down to where you started. So it's sort of like this, and then a slow growth, and then like this, and this. And when you look back over the long haul, the weeks, the months, the years, hopefully decades, what you're going to see is that there's a pattern of exponential growth. The characteristic, that's snowball growth, hockey stick growth. Characteristic of exponential growth is for the first 2 years, first few years, it may not seem very dramatic, but at some point, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, I can't say when, this kind of thing starts to happen. And you realize that you're not on a slow linear path. Even though it may seem that way for a few years, there's the function is the more you grow, the faster you grow. That's what mathematically carries. So you reach the point where you grow as much in a month as you did in 10 years during the early part of your practice. So the rate of growth is proportional to the amount of growth. So that is that's the statistical trend. Once again, I can't promise it's going to be that way for you, but you know, it often is that way. So this is what one needs to do. One needs to prioritize and say, okay, I'm going to allocate time, this amount of time, I'm going to establish this pattern. Now, that's the very minimum. If you can do more retreats, that's better. If you can do longer sits, that's better. But at least do that and maintain it. Now, how can you, people will often ask me, how can I accelerate my growth? Okay, how can I sort of speed up the process of growth in meditation? I can make a few suggestions. One is what's called adhitthana in Pali, which is usually translated in English as strong determination sitting. What that means is you sit down and you decide, okay, I'm going to sit here without moving at all or without moving very much, you know, maybe a little bit of movement, but I'm going to sit for a certain period of time. I'm going to sit for an hour. And you attempt to sit for that hour without getting up. Or you say, I'm going to sit for 90 minutes, or 2 hours, or 3 hours, or 4 hours. When you lift weights, you get strong by adding weight. So one way, is, and you don't have to do this, but one, if you can relate to it, one very good way to accelerate growth is to every once in a while do a long sit and to learn how to gradually add time. So that over the years of your practice, you're gradually working, exploring the possibility of, let's say, sitting for 4 hours without moving. That might seem like a lot, but you don't have to do it, you know, immediately. You just maybe add 5 minutes, you know, every couple months or something. Now, you know middle way, so never to damage the body. However, most people, unless you have some special situation neurologically or something, most people can sit for 4 hours without moving, without any objective damage to the body at all. However, what's going to happen? As you're sitting, you're going to have discomfort, and then as you have discomfort, you're going to have desires and judgments and mental states, and then you're going to have emotions, and so it's going to be challenging. But you can gradually build up your ability to deconstruct, dissolve, equanimize what comes up as you sit longer. Once again, I want to be very clear, I'm not saying a person has to do this, but people will often say, well, you know, I want to go faster. If there's, I say, you sure you want to know how to go faster? Well, one way to go faster is to extend your sits. Work with the physical and emotional and mental things that come up, and you gradually just drill your way through the mind-body states until you can sit there for 4 hours or longer with a big smile on your face. So that's, I mean, I've personally, like, seen someone sit down next to me, go into full lotus, and 12 hours later, get out of full lotus, go to the bathroom, come back, and just do it again. This isn't a legend. I mean, this is like sitting right next to me, okay? So I know it can be done. And I'll tell you how it is done, with a smile on the face. Oh, well, that's years and years and years of training. And is there pain? Yeah. Is there suffering? No. That's why. But that's a gradual training. Gradual training. That's one way we have this expression, push the envelope. Okay? That's one pretty good way to accelerate growth with this practice. There's another thing. People will often say, when I sit and meditate, everything's pretty peaceful. So I never get a chance to work with emotions and that kind of stuff because it just doesn't come up during formal practice. But as soon as I go out into the world, this happens and that happens and I get all triggered. But I can never get the best of both worlds. When I'm out around, all this stuff gets triggered, but I have to take care of business and it's not an ideal situation for practice. When I'm in the ideal situation for practice, this stuff doesn't come up. So I can never sort of bring my practice and my emotional challenges together. Some people say this kind of thing. So I have a suggestion, another way to accelerate your practice. I call it trigger practice. So what you do is you sit down, you do some technique, it doesn't matter whatever technique you want, but you're sitting in front of either a television or an internet, and you're controlling the sonic stimulus. You are in control. You control the content, that's to say the type of stimulus. You control the intensity of the stimulus. You control the duration and how long between the listening. You have this is like a piece of exercise equipment where you have 5 knobs to adjust it. Okay? You adjust the content. Do you want to listen to something that's going to make you laugh? Do you want to listen to something that's angry or frightened or sad or motivated or loving? It doesn't have to necessarily be negative. And let's say that your issue is whatever, anger. So, okay, you decide what I like to work. Anger, but your issue is anger. It comes up in the day all the time, but it never comes up while I sit. So you decide, okay, I want to work with anger. Now, how intense? Do I want to listen to something that irritates me a little? Or I don't want to listen to something that makes me want to go on a murderous rampage against the perpetrator, or anything in between. You decide the type, you decide the intensity, and how long. Am I going to listen for 30 seconds? The image talk emotional body is a bell. And sight, sounds, and physical touches are the striker. Okay? Someone says something. You hear it. A remark. This is your subjective system. This is a remark. The remark does not take long.
Ow!
It's over! Now what's gonna happen? How long is this thing gonna resonate? Okay? As long as it resonates, you can be working with that with a technique. Don't have to re-stimulate, because it goes, right? And you stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. Pause. And then again. Okay? So, you can train yourself in a controlled, systematic way for every one of your hot buttons. Informal practice in front of a computer or a TV set, just listen to the sound. Working smart. It's upaya. It's systematic. Then when you've trained all of your positive and negative emotional circuits, you're ready to walk through life like a colossus, because it's all been trained. It's all on autopilot. As soon as someone says this or you see that, the bell gets struck, but it's all just vibration. It's been trained out of suffering systematically over a period of years. So that's another little clever thing you can do. It has its own challenge, okay? It's sort of like, you know, they all have their challenges. Sit for 4 hours, it's going to involve a bit of pain. You listen to whatever religious or political person you most detest, all that has its own challenge. Okay? Can you experience this without suffering? Can you experience the impact on you as a flow of energy? If you can do that, you can recolor that energy as loving. You can do what few humans have ever been able to do, but what all the religions say we're supposed to do. Well, it is. Well, let's take the religions at their word. Let's see if we can do it. Okay? So, these are a couple suggestions, about where you go from here and what you might need to be successful. So, at the end of every retreat, there's a topic that I am duty-bound to talk about. And it's something that I call aftershock and afterglow. Okay, so people worked hard at this retreat. And this was not a retreat for wimps. Okay? This was the real deal. You were expected to practice at a professional level. And you did. So that's good. When the Buddha wanted to praise someone, the highest praise that he would give in the Pali language, katakaraniya, it means this person did what needed to be done. So we can say this of this group. So that's good. But we also have to make something clear. When people do what needs to be done, in this sense, afterwards there will be exactly one of four consequences. Logically, exactly one of the four following four are going to happen to you in the days and weeks following this retreat. You may have afterglow only. You may have aftershock only. You may have both, or you may have neither. I promise you that there is no fifth logical possibility. This is called a tetralemma, chatushkoti, in Sanskrit. Okay, it's an idea. Okay, it's exactly one of these four. Okay, so what do I mean by afterglow? Afterglow means you're tranquil, you're energized, you're happy, you get a cascade of insights. You will have no difficulty processing afterglow. As a person does more retreats, as more blockages get worked through, there is a statistical tendency that retreats are followed by afterglow, the long term. But in the short term, there is no such guarantee that you will have afterglow. But if you do, now you know what to look for. Now you know what to call it, what to do about it. Just go with it, okay? Enjoy. That's great. Enjoy. Okay, what is aftershock? Aftershock is that you have vulnerability, you have sensitivity, you have disorientation. It seems like the outside world is very invasive. It seems like you're so porous on the inside that stuff is just percolating up for no particular reason, fear or tear or what have you. That's aftershock. Now he tells us, now that it's too late. No, aftershock is not necessarily a bad thing as long as you know it happens and you know what to do about it. The spiritual path, in the literal sense of becoming spirit, if you take spiritual path literally to mean not just think about God and not just feel about God, not just image about God, but actually like directly encounter spirit in our senses, continuously, in daily life, if we take that to be the spiritual path, then the spiritual path is a sequence, not one, not two, not three, a sequence of many, many acclimatizations to less fixated modes of being. Zen Master Rinzai said, within every flesh body, there is an authentic person that has no fixed position. In every flesh body, there is an authentic person that has no fixed position. So, what does that mean? It sounds very strange. Sounded very strange to me, but over time, I came to understand exactly why he said it that way. So, you have to acclimatize to having no fixed position. You gradually get used to it. There's a lot of ways you could describe enlightenment. One of the Zen descriptions of enlightenment is riding an ox backwards. You are trusting this powerful force of nature. You don't need to know where you're going, okay? Enlightenment is like eternally falling off a cliff and being completely comfortable with that. A leaf falls to the ground. An enlightened person falls up from from the ground, moment by moment. Same process. Well, that's ultimate trust. That's ultimate faith. For me, faith and belief are almost opposites. So it's a sequence of acclimatizing to that mode of being. It's like weird and disorienting. And then you sort of get used to it and you function. And you're fine. And then you go to a new depth. And it's even weirder and more disorienting. And then you just sort of get used to it. And I mean, if I had some sort of time machine where, is it, if we were 45 years ago and someone could sort of say, okay, I'm going to put you in the mind and body. So we're back in 1968, okay? And someone says, okay, here's a time machine and I'm going to show you, I'm going to put you in the mind and body that you're going to have, in the year, 2012. Okay? And so someone immediately put me in this present mind and body from that mind and body, from that. Someone put that consciousness in this. It would faint. It would just fall to the floor. Okay? Unconscious. Because it didn't have time to acclimatize to what this is. But I've had decades of gradually getting used to being less and less of a thing and more of a doing. Less and less of a thing called self, more and more of an activity called personality. That's the strange thing. The people, often people that have realized no self have these like room-filling personalities. Okay? Because the somethingness of self has been freed up into the doingness of the wave. But you have to acclimatize, get used to being less of a particle and more of a wave. And it's not just one. So the process of acclimatization, that's aftershock. That's all that is. The normal way that people cope with the outside world is shielding, okay, like this. It sort of works, but doesn't really because the arrows still get through. And the normal way that people cope with the poison and pain within them, this trauma, the stored, is the same thing, okay? But it really doesn't work because the stuff gets through, at least a little bit. But we try to keep our basic strategy for dealing with the impact of the outside and for dealing with what's stored on the inside is tighten up and turn away. Tighten up and turn away. Now we're going to learn mindfulness. Guess what? Mindfulness is open up and turn towards. It is the diametrically opposite strategy. So there's no way to avoid the awkward intermediate zone. Okay? You start to open up a little bit. Okay, so now you're not shielded. You're not shielded from the outside. You're not shielded from the inside. But you're not so open that nothing can catch. But you're not closed so as to relatively armor. So that's what causes aftershock. It's not a sign that you're doing anything wrong. It's a sign that you're in an awkward intermediate state. You're not shielding like you used to, outside and inside, but you haven't yet reached the place where the mesh of the being is so open that nothing can catch, it just passes right through. So you feel the vulnerability, you experience disorientation. It seems like you're very invaded by the outside, and all this stuff is percolating up. So I'm not saying that will happen, but if it does happen, just two things. Remember why it's happening. It's not a sign that anything's wrong. It's actually a sign kata karaniya, that you did something. You did something right. And what to do about it? Nothing. Just let it happen. Just apply a technique. Recycle the reaction. Basic principle in mindfulness. If whatever your technique is, maybe it's an observing technique, then just observe how is that and so forth. And then it sort of works its way through and you acclimatize. To repeat, you could have afterglow. Tranquility, energy, you're happy, okay, you're getting insights. You could have aftershock. Vulnerability, emotionality, disorientation. Now you know what to do about afterglow. You know about what to do about aftershock. Third possibility, you could have both. A little bit of afterglow mixed with a little bit of aftershock. Well, you still know what to do. For the afterglow, enjoy it. For the aftershock, recycle it. Fourth logical possibility, none of the above. Nothing dramatic. No afterglow, no aftershock. Doesn't mean that you didn't do significant work. It just means that this time you didn't have any noticeable surface afterglow or aftershock. But I promise you, in the depths, something always shifts when we do this practice, whether we sense it on the surface or not. So, these are a few of the things that I like to point out to people. Answer the question, what do you need to be successful with this practice, and sort of where do we go from here? What I would strongly encourage you to do is sign up for your next retreat. Put it in your calendar in ink, put down a deposit, and brag to all your friends that you're going to be doing it for this retreat. So now it's a fait accompli. It's a done deal, okay? And if at the end of every retreat you sign up for your next retreat, then that guarantees a lifetime of retreats. Okay. One last thing that I think is important to remember upon leaving the retreat. Sadhana seva. Work we do on ourselves for ourselves, and then how we serve the world. There's the obvious way to serve the world, which is you volunteer, you know, to help. You work for more justice, or you help unfortunate people. You teach, you volunteer in some way. So that's sort of the helping the world in a material way, which is certainly an important aspect of safe. Then there's helping people in a more subtle way. But it's also very, very important. You can be teaching all the time by your ability to take in the poison and pain of others, transmute it into non-suffering within your mind and body, that becomes a kind of subtle teaching. You walk around in the world, and whether people know it or not, by having interacted with you, they've gotten something. And they might not know it, but you know it. And you're fulfilled. There's a common thing that people report as the result of having done spiritual practice. It's like, I pick up all this negative energy from people. Or people drain me with their negativity. This is part of the awkward intermediate zone. If you find yourself thinking that or saying that, just understand, okay, that's a natural stage, but that's being a spiritual teenager. Okay? Being a spiritual, and these are not pejorative terms. I'm not saying this as disrespect or put down. It just is. There are children, there are teenagers, and there are adults. These are natural stages. Most human beings are spiritual children in history. People that do this path, usually become at least spiritual teenagers. The spiritual teenager has some meditative skills, but they go around saying, now that I have this meditative awareness, I'm picking up all this negative energy and people are draining me. That's what a spiritual teenager says. Well, you can't be an adult without passing through teenage. However, I think it is important to bear in mind that your goal is to be a spiritual adult. A spiritual adult enjoys picking up the negativity of the world because they're good at it. They have the skills. They can feel it coming in. They can feel it being digested by their meditative skills in the moment, and they can feel the impact that that has on the people around them. So it's sort of like magic, subtle magic. So I would like you to at least hold out the ideal that that's why you're doing this practice. I don't know if I think I mentioned this. Or maybe it was not in front of the room, but someone was saying about, you know, meditating in the bomb shelters and how the kinds of, like, you guys actually have, like, wars sometime, okay? Well, we don't really have wars in North America, but we did have one thing that happened. Where we were attacked not that long ago. So the 9/11 terrorist attack on the United States occurred right in the middle of a 10-day retreat that I was running. And most of the people that were at that retreat came from New York and Washington. So we were in Virginia, which is just one state away from where that was happening. So that was an amazing experience. So a similar schedule to this, okay, you know, we have the guidance in the morning, like I give you guys, and then take a little break, and okay, now we're going to come back and have some discussion. So in between the guidance and when people came back, the retreat managers came up to me, and it had just happened. It happened 15 minutes ago. And no one was really quite sure what was going on. But they knew that it was war. But no one was sure how extensive, how many planes. Is this like really like an all-out war? I mean, are we going to be attacked? No one really quite knew, and you couldn't make any telephone calls. The whole infrastructure went down. And they told me what had happened. As best we knew at that point. So, you know the poet Yeats? Okay. So Yeats, there's this line about Yeats. the center will not hold, something like that, the center cannot hold, right? It's a famous line from a poem. So this line went through my head. I just out of nowhere. Center will hold. And I decided we're going to continue our retreat. We are at war, okay? We're going to continue this retreat. So we didn't immediately tell everybody because we had to plan. I had to talk to the retreat managers. And this was a retreat that we usually use Catholic places, but this place was actually a Protestant place. It was Methodist. It was like in the South, okay? If you know about the United States, that's where you get these Bible, very conservative Christians. But they were hosting us. And it was really a beautiful thing because we worked with these Methodist ministers to figure out what we were going to do about this situation. So I decided we're not going to just let this thing dissipate just because this has happened. So we told everyone, we set up ways to that people could communicate if they needed to, but we kept the silence. There was a place where people could make phone calls, watch television, and talk if they needed to, but the retreat was still in silence. The schedule still continued. That night, we didn't have a Dharma talk. We had a talking circle. People would share their... And some people thought their relatives had been killed and whatever, but we weren't that impacted, fortunately. Turned out, everybody was in that retreat, their families were safe. And so, no one left the retreat. We just continued. And we did the whole retreat throughout the whole thing. Why I'm sharing this with you is because of what happened when the retreat was over. So the retreat was over 5 days after the attack. And America was not like America that I ever knew. Really weird vibe. Because historically, we've never been attacked. Not the mainland, okay? That is a huge psychological shift. And things were really weird, and people were really off kilter. And there was no one in the airports. No one. But we had to travel, because, you know. And so you're traveling, and there's no one there. No one's traveling. It was just a very weird vibe and a very weird situation. And so when we had our talking circle, we decided that because we had had the privilege to process this whole thing in a meditation retreat, we were now empowered to walk out into that shell-shocked environment and just subtly support everyone just by taking it in and processing it. And everyone that was there, if you were to talk to them, will tell you that this was one of the most amazingly empowering experiences of their life. It certainly was for me. I walked out of that retreat and I just knew that I knew exactly what needed to be done. With the pores of my skin, not with this mouth. Okay? How I needed to walk down the street, how I needed to sit in the airport to purify the land around as the result of the practice. So upon leaving the retreat, I'd like you to consider why we, in the end, really do this. Yeah, it's so that we could be happy individually, but it's also so that we can walk through the world as a teacher. Sometimes there's this tendency at the end of the retreat to sort of like dread the karma closet that's waiting out there. Like, you know, you stuffed all your karma in a closet, right? And now you're going to leave. You're going to have to open that closet. And I would encourage you not to dread it. Not to dread what the headlines will be or how people will be. But to just remember that you have something special. You know something that most people don't know. You have something to give.